at 11:30 a.m.
On Longwave and DAB Digital Radio now, it's time for the Daily Service, led by Andrew Greystone. Many female school leavers are left unemployed after following careers advice and struggling to get into low-paid, oversubscribed jobs like hairdressing. In Woman's Hour at 10 o'clock, Carol Easton, the chief executive of the Young Women's Trust, will explain the problem and the damaging effect of gendered job advice. And office picnics, a look at the perhaps lost art of picnicking with colleagues. Join Jenny Murray in 15 minutes. Before that, here on Radio 4, the book of the week, Hopeful, the autobiography written and read by the comedian and actor Omid Jalili. Born in Britain to Iranian parents, Omid's sense of identity has always been a negotiation between two cultures. Today, he reflects on his unconventional upbringing in a guest house in Kensington.
When I was a child, I thought our large family had an extremely wide and varied social circle. In reality, I was raised in a crazy and colourful guest house. My parents had started taking in lodgers almost as soon as they arrived in London in 1958. This part of their work began gradually. It grew out of a Persian custom. When you went overseas, you would stay with friends of friends and pay a little something to your host for costs and expenses. This slowly turned into the main family income. Although my parents were excited to be in London, they always assumed they would return home to Iran at some point. The Islamic Revolution in 1979 put an abrupt halt to that plan. By the mid-1970s, our large apartment had become a major hub of activity in West London. It was like living in the central location for an epic, never-ending movie. The supporting cast were sick Iranians from all backgrounds, who had come to the UK for medical procedures, eye examinations, intestinal explorations, heart operations, cancer treatment, leg removals, skin disease, brain disease. Due to these guests paying so much money for their medical treatment, never at any point did anyone exploit the NHS, my parents' roles as down-to-earth carers became even more meaningful. They provided a home-from-home for Iranians, away from the formality of Harley Street, where many of these patients went for consultations. It was around this time that I embarked upon what could have been a burgeoning career as a medical translator. As a 10-year-old, I had a strange gravitas, rare in a child of tender years. I was often put in the position of having to discuss patients' intimate medical conditions with some of the top Harley Street professionals. Looking back, it seems odd that this was never presented to me as an actual career path. As a bilingual British-Iranian child savvy with medical terms, I had unusual translating dexterity. But it never occurred to me that this was a highly sought-after skill through which I could have made a decent living. Today, it's a specialised job at institutions like the United Nations. Sadly, this career was thwarted before it had a chance to flourish, mainly due to an unfortunate incident involving a man who was recovering from a kidney operation. I had misunderstood my father's request to go to the Brompton Hospital on Fulham Road and don't just sit there and translate, but to, you know, stay and keep him entertained a little. What he meant was the patient, Mr. Rezai, was slightly depressed and missed his own children. My father thought it would be kind if I, as a child, could sit with him a while, have a little chat and socialise, rather than just translate in a scarper. For some reason, though, I got it into my head that this meant I had to actually entertain. The doctor arrived, and after some pleasantries and the usual surprise regarding my age, we got down to business. Can you ask him if he slept well? Khub khabidin? Bale. Yes, he did. Excellent. Ask him if he gets thirsty in the middle of the night. Nisfa shab tishnatun shod? Ye kemi. He says a little. Excellent. Does he have trouble passing wind? Sorry? Wind. Ask him if he has trouble passing wind. A spanner in the works. I had no idea what he meant. My father trained me, though, that when I didn't understand, I just had to ask the doctor to elaborate. I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean. You know, wind. You mean like the wind blowing outside? No. You know, when you've eaten a lot and, it was getting tense. I felt I was letting us all down. How could I know terms for pleural effusions, but have no idea about wind? Finally, the doctor made a modest little squat and said wind again to indicate gas being expelled. Oh, you mean farting? Yes, I suppose. Yes, exactly. Yes. Shall I ask if he did a fart last night? Yes. Okay. Nisbashab shoma guze mohkam tushab mizanin. Here the patient started to smile broadly. I saw he was visibly controlling himself. Having undergone a kidney transplant, patients are told to avoid laughter at all costs. In extreme cases, it's known to literally split sides. With anxiety in his smile, he said yes to the question about passing wind, but it was the translation that was causing him more discomfort. Overcompensating for my lack of understanding regarding wind, I'd asked him if he farted with force and said it with unwarranted aggression, straightening my arm at a right angle. The doctor made his excuses and left. I sat by the patient's bedside and stared at him. Remembering my dad said he needed entertaining, I deliberated my next move. So, I said, how are you? He looked at me, eyebrows furrowed with trepidation, but with a wide smile. I'm fine. An uneasy silence ensued. I then launched into a joke about a chicken from Qazvin, a region in Iran known for its large homosexual population. The very concept of a 10-year-old starting a joke about a gay chicken was a lot for him to bear, and he covered his mouth in anticipation. I finished the joke, and he started laughing uncontrollably. He called for the nurse, and with underlying hysteria, motioned her with a wave, saying, "Biggin bitter," which means, "Get him out of here!" Of course, I translated this with the same urgency, not realizing he meant me. Before I knew it, three nurses had arrived, and a green curtain swiftly went up around him. He was clearly in trouble, and I heard the words, "Stitches, quickly." I was told in no uncertain terms to get out. I left the hospital feeling traumatized and baffled. I rarely translated again. The Iranian Revolution of 1979 happened swiftly and was perceived by many as a conservative backlash in response to the westernization and secularization of Iran by the Shah. It was on BBC News daily and affected me personally, as it was the first time in my life that Iranians were brought sharply into focus in the Western media. It became the backdrop to everything that happened to me during that period. As a 13-year-old adolescent with bum fluff and a drooping nose, I sat watching constant images of death and rioting on TV coming from Tehran, and was alarmed by scenes of fanatics beating themselves in so-called Islamic fervour. Relationships at school, previously harmonious, became fraught. It was hard explaining what was going on to my friends. In response to their questions, I regurgitated random things guests had said at home. Ayatollah Khomeini is a puppet put in by the Americans to keep the oil prices down. Jimmy Carter is paying people to demonstrate. Iran is going backwards into the dark ages. The situation was, of course, far more complex than the media were presenting. When seismic world events take place, they're often shrouded in confusion, and the Islamic Revolution was no exception. What complicated matters further was the fact that we were Baha'is, not Muslims. The Baha'is were, and remain, a persecuted minority in Iran. Being Iranians, we were already a minority in Britain. This meant that when dealing with Iranian Muslims in London, my family was actually a minority within a minority. Add that to the fact that some Baha'is in the London community thought my family, due to their business, were more than a little strange. So quite uniquely, I felt like a minority within a minority within a minority. Added to this, I felt like I was an actual alien within my own family. The levels of cosmic isolation were profound and overwhelming. News was filtering through of Baha'is in Iran being executed. Apart from being emotionally traumatic for my parents, who personally knew a number of those executed, it inevitably affected their work. Their clientele were mostly Muslims, many of whom were severely prejudiced against the Baha'is due to the government-controlled propaganda. It was almost impossible to ascertain which of our Muslim guests were prejudiced against the Baha'is and which were more tolerant. So a policy evolved to steer away from any talk of religion. Baha'is were being executed because they refused to deny their faith. So out of respect to the guests, as well as to protect ourselves, the question of our religious identity was never discussed. If a situation were to arise where we were required to admit being Baha'is, denial was not an option, then there was a distinct possibility that some of the guests might feel compelled to leave. As a young boy, what I found most unsettling was the fact that these people were receiving our hospitality, happily sitting in our house, eating, having fun, talking freely, but not knowing we were Baha'is. In the summer of 1980, a family of five called the Hashemis from Mashhad in Iran came to stay. My father and Mr. Hashemi got on very well, and by an amazing stroke of fortune, each of their three children were the exact same age as myself and my siblings. We loved the Hashemis. Their youngest, a fair-skinned, frail-looking girl called Fariba, was painfully sweet, and though not a great conversationalist herself, she thought I was very funny. They'd come to England to deal with her mystery illness. There was only one other guest at that time, a Mr. Kolahi, a flamboyant character who wore loud coloured cravats and was prone to bouts of depression, drinking and gambling. But one evening, he sat quietly at the table, simply observing the two families in after-dinner conversation, as we munched on the caviar and chocolates the Hashemis had brought over for us. "Not bad this," my dad said. "Caviar and chocolates. This is the high life." Which suddenly triggered Mr. Hashemi to give an impromptu speech. "Mr. and Mrs. Jalili," he said grandly, "I need to say something. Your names are very well known in Iran. Well known and well loved. When my Fariba got this illness, we knew we had to come to England. And for what our friends said, there was only one place to come. To the Jalilis. The place is homely and you can relax in the house just like it's your own. If you are sick, staying there will make you feel better." And they were right. We do feel better. We are lucky we found you. God willing, Fariba's recovery will be more rapid for staying here. God bless you all. Everybody was moved. For the first time, I'd heard someone articulate the purpose of this guest house. That night, I slept in a bedroom. The revolution had cut our clientele by half, and at 15, I was finally able to have my own room. I awoke later to noises. No voices, just a lot of bumping and banging. I looked at my digital clock and saw the time was 2:18 a.m. Then the front door closed shut. Silence. I went back to sleep. It was only when I got up for breakfast and saw the ashen faces of my parents that I knew something had upset them gravely. I learned later that Mr. Kolahi had stayed up late, drinking and talking to Mr. Hashemi until about 2 a.m. In a tipsy haze, he'd mentioned we were Baha'is. Without a word of warning or explanation, Hashemi woke his family up, got them to pack immediately, and they all left by the front door, bumping and banging their luggage as they went. This explained the thick atmosphere at breakfast the next morning. Mr. Kolahi was eating normally as if nothing had happened, my father standing over him cooking eggs, my mother dealing with the toast. I came in, sat next to him, and had my breakfast before going off to school. No one said a word. Moments earlier, Mr. Kolahi had told my father that he had revealed to Hashemi that we were Baha'is, and that was probably why they left. Keeping his dignity, my father simply said, "That's up to them," and continued to fry eggs. This upset me later, as I considered Mr. Kolahi's revelation to be calculated and bewildering. More confusing, though, was why Mr. Kolahi didn't leave himself and continued to visit us, often getting drunk and needing to be carried to bed, which my father did obediently and without judgment for the next 15 years.
And Ahmed Jalili will continue his autobiography, Hopeful, at the same time, 9:45 tomorrow. It was abridged by Lou Kemp and was produced by Kirsty Williams.
The police drama Craven returns to BBC Radio 4.
Nobody's doing anything! You're all useless!
2 days before Christmas, DCI Craven finds herself investigating a tragic and appalling crime.
She rang 999 at 11:05. The paramedics got there in 15 minutes. There was nothing they could do. We read about it, appalled, confounded, why? No, I had that rare and precious thing, the person who could tell me.
Starring Maxine Peake, Craven returns next Monday morning at 10:45 on BBC Radio 4.
How about a picnic by the printer? Woman's Hour will have a novel idea for office bonding after the news.